Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 20th, 2019, and welcome to episode 186 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, bidding, winning, losing, and all things of that sort. I'm Paul Hagstrom in snowy Boston, and I am joined today by Carrington Vanston in snowy Toronto.
I'm actually Carrington Vanston no matter where I go. It's not like a Toronto-specific thing. Crazy thing, little trivia about me, I remain Carrington. I'm like a steady state of me.
Excellent.
For better or worse.
Yeah, so once again, as the recording time approached, people dropped like flies. So we hope everybody feels better and all that. But so it's just two of us yet again.
Sickness abounds.
But a big bunch of snow landed on us today. So it's exciting. Winter has arrived finally.
We got a bunch yesterday. You know, winter is coming, now winter is here. It's Canada. So, of course, winter was coming here. And we are, as I look out from my window, it is a winter wonderland out there. Boo. Boo to it, I say. I'm not a fan.
But as long as you're inside, it's nice.
Yeah, but I eventually have to go outside. I mean, I guess technically pizza is delivered. So,
that's right.
I could see how long I could make it. But to afford pizza, I have to go out and do work. Boo.
Yes.
Boo to work.
Yeah, I'm right on the edge of the beginning of the next semester, and oh boy, am I not ready. But, yes. Speaking of things I'm not ready for, today's host topic. Though I think this is something we decided on the topic for today would be just kind of like search strategies and things about finding things on eBay, and I sort of feel like I could possibly wing it on that, so...
One would hope, given the number of amazing things you have found for the eBay section of all the episodes we've done, I would think you are as skilled as this, or at least as experienced as this, as any of our listeners, so that you can help us find those sweet, sweet eBay deals that supposedly exist. Or we could talk about safety things, we could talk about how to actually search and find a thing, how to know that you're buying a thing that is actually legitimate, what are things to look out for. There's lots of things. We got this. Yep. We got this, Paul. We got this. So in fact, speaking of which, so let's just talk about the basic idea. Let's imagine that I'm a person. Let's imagine, Paul. Okay. Imagine I'm a person. But more than that...
Okay, working on it. Hang on.
I'll give you time. But more than just being a person, I'm a specific type of person who's looking to buy a vintage computer-y thing, piece of software or an old printer or whatever. So, like a normal human, I would go to eBay.com and I just type those words in. I just type, like, you know, TRS-80 printer, and I hit return, and I'm deluged with 5 million results, a lot of which seem to be for baskets and clothing and furniture. And it's like, what's going on? It can be a bit of a confusing marketplace. So what are the first most, you know, like 5,000 mile overview things that somebody could do to narrow down a search like that to be more focused on what they're actually looking for, which is, say, in this case, say, like an old vintage printer?
Oh, you're asking?
Yeah, I'm asking. You've got okay. All this knowledge. Hit me with your sweet science.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's all kinds of things to say. I mean, one thing is that at least as a first pass, you can probably trust the categorization. So, you know, everything in eBay is generally categorized in certain kinds of things. So there's like computing, there's business machines, there's, you know, toys and games and things like that. So if you're looking for a printer, if you click on the computers, usually there's a subcategory of I forget what it's called, like vintage computers and mainframes, I think. So someone who knows what they're doing when they list will put it in that category, so that you can narrow at least to
but
that.
They will also know what it's worth, and they'll want the most money.
Right.
The best seller, if you're a buyer, the best seller is somebody who has no idea what something is, but has somehow listed it accurately enough that you know what it is.
Right.
That's the sweet spot.
It's always good to know more than the person you're buying it from.
Now, so I have a question for you. If somebody lists something on eBay and they have placed it in the vintage computer section, that's not put in that category by eBay. It's put in there by the seller, right? Mm-hmm. They have themselves chosen to put it there. So somebody could mischaracterize something.
Yeah, that definitely happens. So one way that could happen is even somebody who's sort of experienced with eBay might, you know, generally be selling a bunch of postcards that they found, and they also found this computer, and they accidentally list the computer in the category with the postcards, you know, just because they're following their template.
And then nobody bids on it but you.
Right. And that's sort of delightful. You know, in a way, I feel bad. But it kind of depends on the egregiousness of the error. I sort of feel like if someone really was selling something that was worth thousands for like $35, I might be tempted to let them know that they have made an error. But
I have actually done that in the past. There's been a few times where I've contacted the seller for something and said, I think you've mischaracterized this or it's missing the word for something, or did you know like that card and it is worth a lot. I will admit I've never done that on anything that I've looked to bid on, but I'd like to think that I would. It's just always been the few times it's come up is something where I've just noticed, but it hasn't been something I've been looking to actually buy. Because I'm not looking to buy a lot. So I like to believe that I am of such fine character that I would tell somebody anyway, but I have yet to be tested. My mettle is untested in that way. So another thing we should talk about is the basic idea, before we start diving into I'd like to get into specific things, but in that I think it's the case, you know a lot more about eBay than I do, that a basic string, if I type the words like Apple, Atari, Tandy, that means it's only going to show me listings that have all three of those words. And the way to turn that into like an or search instead of an and search is to put it in parentheses with commas, correct? So like open parentheses, Apple, comma, Atari, comma, Tandy, close parentheses would give me anything that had like any of those words instead of all of those words. I think that's right, right?
I have no idea. That's very interesting. I'm learning things too.
Pretty sure that that's the case, because that's how I've always structured my in fact, I'm going to pull up my eBay things here. Mm-hmm. Where's an example of that? Yeah, okay, so here's one. There was a time ages ago I was looking for a Smith Corona Messenger module. It's a thing that lets you turn a particular type of Smith Corona printer or typewriter into a printer. I got one of those, got it working. It was super fun. But in searching for that, it was difficult because is it going to be under typewriters? Is it going to be under computers? I'm looking for the words. So if I just type like Smith Corona and Messenger and module, I get everything from all over eBay that just has the word Messenger in it.
Right.
Or module. So I'm getting way more stuff than I want. But if I put it in quotes, like Smith Corona Messenger module, I won't get something that just has Messenger module and like Smith Corona A Messenger module or whatever. So my search for that, for instance, was, quote, Smith Corona, close quote. I wanted that phrase exactly. And then separately in parentheses, Messenger, comma, cable, comma, parallel, close parentheses. So that gave me anything that has the word Smith Corona and also one of the words Messenger, cable, or parallel. And that was enough to narrow it down to I want either typewriters that can work with these things or the Messenger module. It kind of like put me in the sweet spot for all the stuff to do with that thing and let me track down both the typewriter and the Messenger module.
Cool.
So that seems to be a good way to phrase something when sometimes you're looking for something. Because if you're looking for something in the Atari world, or rather in the Apple world, Apple means a lot of things other than computers. In fact, some would argue that it primarily means actual apples. So right. there's a lot of things out there that have nothing to do with computers. And so sometimes I want to like narrow it down more, but go broader than just the categories. So anyway, that's a thing I've used, the or search instead of the and search a lot. You can kind of craft something. And also the negative keywords. On top of my head, if you're looking for something that's like, say you want a G4 Power Mac because you want to run like modern operating system, but also still be able to run Mac OS 9, like the classic operating system. And I think that tops out of the G4. So I would search for things like Power Mac and Macintosh and maybe Mac Cube or whatever. But you can use the negative keyword, like negative G3 and like literally the hyphen G3 and hyphen G5. That means it won't show you anything that have the words G3 or G5 in them. So you can use a negative keyword, just like a Google search. A lot of things you could use in a Google search, you can use in an eBay search. You got to be careful because you might then not be showing something because somebody writes the words, oh, this isn't one of those stinking G5s. This is a beautiful G3 or G4 and I only want $8. And you won't see it because it won't show it to you. But it can be useful sometimes if you're getting overwhelmed by things. Mm-hmm. So those are two ideas. What do you got, Paul?
And amazingly, I have not actually really been using those advanced search functions at all. So
is it because you simply go to the vintage computer category and look at everything there?
Well,
you have more time than the rest of us.
There is a sad kind of truth to that.
So, because that's another approach, is simply be comprehensive.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I have a ton of saved searches, and the one thing that I have used a fair amount is direct quoting. You know, so if I'm looking for the popular electronics magazine, I will put quotes around it, and so at least it's not just finding things that are popular and electronics. You know.
Right, you want that phrase exactly as it exists, right?
Yeah, so.
And as far as I know, capitalization does not matter, I think, with an eBay search. You don't need to search for, like, Tandy with an uppercase T and also Tandy with a lowercase T. Just the letters are the letters. I'm pretty sure about that. I'm going to go all in. I'm 100% sure.
Right. It's possible even, like, accents and diacritics might not matter.
Hmm.
But yeah, I mean, like, I do search for, you know, quote Apple II, unquote. And actually, I have many variants of this. So,
but the problem there is, do you spell it as the let P? The problem is everybody else selling these things aren't you. Right. You would always spell Apple II, APPLE space capital I capital I. But the general public wants to spell it with the digit II. Mm-hmm. So you have to do your search like, I want Apple space digit two, I want Apple II with no space, I need Apple space II, like all these things.
Yeah. So I have searches for Apple digit two, Apple digit three, Apple 111, Apple 11C. You know.
Well, one way you could streamline that is drop the stuff for the Apple III.
Right.
Just completely.
Exactly.
So there's a tip from me to you. Get rid of that sucker.
Apple LLC, Apple LLE, because, you know, I've seen...
Oh, right.
One thing, I don't know what people are thinking, but, you know, sometimes people will list their Apple IIs with, like, you know, because maybe they actually know what they're doing. They grew up in the 80s, you know, and they write Apple, close bracket, open bracket. It's like, what is that?
Oh, right. Of course, but people are looking out. Maybe they're looking
at the badge.
They might not have grown up. They just take the badge, and the badge is spelled that way, so they type it in. But if you're not searching for that, I guess, which I never have, you wouldn't see that. Or with the slash, I guess people must also spell it like 2E, like backslash E. Or is that forward slash? I don't get my slashes right.
It's
I just say slash.
Slash.
So slash slash E.
Yeah.
Okay, forward slash.
It's one of those things. It's one of those things I often scream at the, you know, the podcast about or whatever. It's like, no, if you use backslash, you're not going to get where you want to be. Do not put that in your web address.
Don't use slashes, period. So anyway, those are things. Another tip that comes to mind is to know, ideally, like if you know what you're looking for, to be aware of other names for that thing or other models that are the same. Like one of my favorite computer models is the Macintosh LC475, but that is also the Quadra 605, essentially the same computer. So if you're doing a search, you'd want to search for LC475 and also Quadra 605, and it was also called the Performa 475. And there's the Performa 476, much more rare, but might come up, and if you're only searching for 475, you won't see it. So knowing those things, like other names for things, can be helpful, and you put them all into a string. And like you, Paul, if I've got something I'm looking for, I will kind of craft it, and then I'll create a save search so I can go back and just jump right in and see what's new in this for this thing. Like say sorted by new, and then every time I go to it, it'll just show me like from newest to oldest what's the latest stuff, and I can scroll down and quickly see has anything else been listed recently that would match that search of the stuff that I'm currently going for.
Yeah, I don't know how many saved searches I have, but it's quite a lot. And I've actually found it really useful on the iOS app, the saved searches, it has a really nice function where essentially if there's something new in one of your saved searches, it will show you those things and nothing else. And then, like, so the first time you go in and it says it has new things, it'll show you just like the 9 things that are new in that category. Next time you go in when there's nothing new, then it'll just show you, you know, in descending order of chronology, right? But
oh, that's handy. So you can really literally just see what's new if that's all you're interested in.
Yeah, and I've never been able to replicate that on the web.
Ah, the web is a fad. And
it's just always, you have to remember what was the last time you saw something. But
Now, have you ever searched for very specific things like computer model numbers or something like that? Have you found that that's useful?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I definitely had a number of the things that I have here. And I'm like scrolling through my list. So I have Quadra 630 in quotes there.
Because you like one that's not destroyed.
Right. That was added after, maybe I bought the one that you were talking about. I think I did.
Yeah, I think so. And then that's the one that shipped and got all wrecked up when it came to you. So I listened to the show.
Yeah. So I have G7287, which happens to be the model number of the Unidisc 3.5-inch, you know, Apple II disk drive.
Mm-hmm. And I do find that that kind of thing can be useful. I remember when I was looking for, what was it? I think the Apple IIc. And if not, that would be a good example. The original Apple IIc, not the Plus. It came in a few different models. And there's the A2S 4000, and there's the A2S 4100. And then I think the 2C Plus is the A2S 4500. But anyway, the A2S 4100 is the version of the original Apple IIc with the nicer keyboard. There's two different keyboards in that, and one feels a lot nicer than the other. And so if you want an Apple IIc, the sweet one to get is the A2S 4100. So if you search for that, it would help it narrow down. Now, a lot of people listing something, they wouldn't know that that's what it is, but I find that even people that are not like super into old computers will often not know what's important. So they'll not only take photos of, say, labels, they'll type in the info from a label. So it will appear, even if someone says, I don't know what this is, but it says Apple IIc model number, whatever, and that's what they put in their listing. So you can find it from someone who's not necessarily like into a super sharky eBay seller. They're just somebody who typed everything from the label.
Right. And that's actually, I've often found that people will misidentify an Apple IIe is an Apple IIc for that reason. When they don't know what they don't know what they're doing, and they look at the badge and the way that the E is stylized, it's open, you know, like there's so you can imagine it looking like a C if you had never seen it before. This is also why it often winds up being LLE.
Right.
Or whatever. Right. But yeah, I have a search for A2S 4500, which is the 2C Plus.
Which is so expensive.
Yeah. I have one that's set for A2S 1, which is supposed to alert me to any original Apple IIs. So that's the beginning.
And does it?
It usually does, actually. But those are also the ones that almost never does someone sell when they don't know what they have. So.
Okay, and do you use the asterisk as a wild card?
I haven't. I've been basically just, you know, like, I think there's sort of an implied asterisk, you know, in a sense. Like, if I search for A2S1, it will find anything that contains that. But,
Because I never have as well. I think it's a thing you can do, and I wasn't sure, and I figured I'd learn from you.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. So, I had a search for rec b.s.m Pandora, which I've had for years, I think. And that was based on the fact that, I don't know, I think we talked about this maybe, you know, a year ago or something. But it was a board game that Apple turned into someone actually, you know, wrote it up as a computerized game. And then Apple marketed it. So they, you know, sold it in a nice little Apple box.
Oh, okay, wait, I understand now. When you said rec.b, I'm thinking rec as an REC, like this is a Alt. Pandora. I'm old enough that I immediately say, I'm like, oh, Wreck with a W. Like, it's, the Wreck of the BSM Pandora. Sorry, I'm like, why are you searching for that? Like, I don't understand. Okay, wait, I'm with you now. I'm back following what you're saying.
So, anyway, yeah, so this was some kind of like strategy board game thing that was turned into a computerized version. Apple sold it in a regular Apple package, box. But I think it must not have been sold for very long. I think it was sold late, so it was like one of the later things that they sold before they just stopped selling things like this. Because it is just unbelievably hard to find. I mean, I think I've seen it maybe twice, maybe that's generous. It might have only been once on eBay. But in my search, it actually does pick up the board game, so there's a board game, and it was also published in a magazine. So it's regularly giving me results, but it's never showing me the Apple one. And then
not the actual Apple game, right?
And the Apple one did actually show up on eBay, and my search didn't catch it. Like, I saw it searching for something else, and so that was kind of irritating. And so now I have a search for also just Wreck BSM Pandora with no dots, because apparently that was how they listed that one. So the next
time, or I guess if you just search for just the words Wreck and Pandora, you'll get anything that has those two words.
Yeah. And that would have been probably smarter.
Just spend your whole life searching for those all the time.
Yeah.
Because with BSM, do people put the dots? Do the dots count? I don't know, man. eBay can be confusing. Right. Just so I'm clear, you're searching for the Apple II game. You're not trying to set up a new Usenet group. Although, have you considered setting up a Usenet group, rec.b.s.m.pandora?
Because that actually is kind of funny.
I would read it.
Come to think of it.
And then if we could just play it on Usenet.
I have a search for where in North Dakota, which also gives me weird results. But that one is never going to find what I want. But there was a very... I'm not even sure if it was fully released, but there was a Carmen Sandiego game. Where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego? That was specially made for the state.
So the Pandora one, you're saying like it never ever came up, and then it finally came up and your search didn't find it, so you missed it. So that's a shame. That said, I would say a good general tip is, especially if you're like starting to listen to the show and you want to get back into collecting or you want to buy something, my advice always is don't buy anything. Won't fill the hole, man. But my advice really is don't buy anything right away. Like, no matter how rare, ultra rare Steve Jobs !! It claims to be, I promise it's not. So you get in and you think, oh, what was that game I liked? Oh, and you go on, you search for it. You'll find one. They want $200. Don't buy it. Just look at it. Wait a bit. Make a search. You'll see how frequently things come up and get a feel for what things really sell for or how rare something actually is. And nothing is as rare as anybody thinks it is. And you can also search on eBay for old things, right? I think you can do a search and say, only show me closed listings or something. And then you can get a sense of what's sold in the past. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever done that.
Yeah. I actually use that a lot. If I'm looking
at, see, you're the pro.
Right. So if I open up a search, sometimes it's just a way to be depressed. You open up a search for something you're really looking for. you can change it to either completed or sold. And I usually go for completed because it includes sold. So you can see, if you look at completed, you can see when things have repeatedly gone unsold. I think it goes back like a month or something. It's not super long, but if you look at sold, you can see what people were willing to pay for the thing. But if you also look at a more general category, you can see when somebody managed to see a listing right away and bought it.
And it depresses you. So you do this just as a way to make yourself feel good. Look at the stuff I missed out on.
Exactly.
That doesn't seem healthy at all.
So I usually try not to do that.
So I do know that one thing I wasn't really aware of until I don't even know when I became aware of this, but at some point, there are some things that come up a lot, but by the same seller. Like, so somebody clearly has like a stash of 50 of something and they sell them one at a time frequently, and they sell, but then like, here's another. And it's the same person just selling it. And it's not that they're scamming people. I think they literally have a ton of these things to sell, a warehouse of them, for instance. There was some large box games I remember buying from someplace in South America or something who started listing them all. I'm like, okay, I'll buy some of those. And that's a weird thing that comes up. Like, the same person will sell things over and over.
Yeah.
Nothing as rare as you think.
But it definitely is worth waiting to get a sense. I mean, I think by now I tend to, if there's something that I, like, I know what's rare in a way, mostly by now. So if I see something that I know I've never seen before, like I would have totally bought the Wreck of the BSM Pandora, except it just went super high, you know, like, not surprisingly, because it is as rare as I believed it to be. But,
And I guess once you've done, like you have, like bought a bunch of things and been on eBay for a bunch of years, you would get a sense. So if you see something, you go, oh, I don't remember seeing that before. It probably, that tells you it's rare because it's nothing you've seen that often. Whereas if it's like, oh, there's that game again. People want $200 for it, but I feel like I've seen that 15 times. And so it's, you know, it's not, you can feel comfortable that if you don't buy it, it's going to come around again. And honestly, almost everything does. And the reality is the interest in these things is a vanishing market. Most people are really interested in them, but we're all going to die. And people younger than us, my nephew doesn't want any of this stuff. It's all just going to get dumped. The last person interested can have all of it for next to nothing. There's only so many museums who are going to need these things, and they can all just get one of them. But like, how many Apple IIs are actually going to be needed 200 years from now? Like the reality is everything will eventually get cheap. You're just trying to balance between how much life do you have left and how long do you want to wait to get it cheap? And how much would you enjoy having it more before you die? Make things dark.
Yeah.
So we should talk a bit about shipping. We have spoken a number of times about like disasters of shipping. You get something in it, like you, for instance, with the Quadra 630 you bought, and that showed up like a box of Smarties. So that's why sometimes like bargain shipping price isn't really a bargain, because if somebody's selling something large or fragile and they're only charging $8 shipping, it's probably going to be packed accordingly, and that might not be in your best interest. Mm-hmm. So there's always that balance between wanting to get something at a discount, but also wanting the seller to pack things very carefully. When I've looked to buy something, and you'll look at the reviews of somebody and say, like, you know, what is their seller rating? One of the things I look for in their reviews from previous buyers is people using phrases like packed incredibly well or packed like a tank or something like that to give me a sense that this seller does at least use some bubble wrap or something. Because one hopes, because boy, man, things get smashed up and it's all old brittle plastic that we're collecting here. And it's very easy for things to get shattered in shipping.
Yeah, I think people really don't quite comprehend the abuse that these packages undergo. I mean, it's not like putting it in the back of your car and driving it to, you know, across town. It's, these things get dropped off of trucks. And yeah, the plastic's old, the metal's heavy, you know, so that's not helping. A lot of times there's space inside, so stuff rattles around and, you know, breaks. Sometimes I see people kind of get anxious when the shipping costs as much or more than the base price that the thing cost, but that seems like a completely irrelevant concern. I mean, like, You are ultimately paying the entire amount for the thing, and
right. I get it though. There's that perception though. You don't want to buy a thing. The item costs $10 and the shipping costs $15, and people think, well, that seems outrageous. But I say, okay, well, let's instead say the item is $22 and the shipping is $3, same price, but it feels better. So I get it. Like it feels better to have shipping be a small percentage of it. I think people play that game a lot in marketing stuff. Like you create a thing to sell and people often kind of artificially inflate the cost of the item so they can artificially deflate the shipping price. They get that same total price overall, but it markets better because people just emotionally want the shipping to be a smaller percentage.
Yeah, that's...
Didn't you say recently that you prefer it when shipping is kind of just included for free? There was some sort of advantage when you get discounts or something?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, the eBay somewhat regularly will... Well, so when you buy something on eBay, they will usually give you this this thing they call eBay Bucks, which is some small percentage. I mean, it's like 1% or 2% or something of the base purchase price, excluding shipping. And sometimes they'll have... They will frequently have this sort of like period where if you buy something in this category today, you know, it'll be 10% instead of 2 or 8% or something like that. And so in those cases, so it's ideal if the shipping is folded into the base price because that's what you're getting the 8% on, right? But
Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, the problem with having free shipping for this stuff, like if it's, depends on what it is, but if you have free shipping, that means you largely have no control over the shipping. So you can't pick something, and you can't really request that they spend a little bit more on it because they've already kind of like accounted for the cost. So
I guess you could do a make offer, which is something we haven't talked about on eBay as a basic thing. Things can be listed where you bid on them. They can also be listed as a buy it now, where you just agree, I'll just jump in, I give you $25, we'll close it right then, you jump to the end. So things can be listed either or both of those ways. And on the buy it now, it can sometimes have a make offer. So I guess technically you could say, I want to make an offer that's higher than your buy it now. Look, I know you're selling it for $50 with free shipping. I would like to give you $75. Please give me $25 with a bubble wrap in my package.
I wonder if I've never actually tried offering more than they're asking, but
say, dear Lord, please.
Yeah, I mean, so it used to, I think some of these things are getting a little bit harder, but it used to be the case. So eBay is relatively protectionist in that they, I don't know to what extent they scan their emails, but they definitely do not want you to talk to the seller and decide, okay, I want your thing, but let's make this deal outside of eBay, you know, because eBay takes, I think, 10% or something like that of the both the shipping and the base cost. So there is there's no advantage when you're a seller now. I think there used to be, but there's no advantage in how you divide the shipping and the base cost because they're getting the same amount either way. And then PayPal takes a like 2.5% or something as well. So sellers aren't making as much as you're paying.
Which makes sense. I guess the PayPal and eBay have to fund their services, so they're taking their cut. They're vig.
So it used to be the case that once you complete an eBay transaction and send your PayPal, you know, amount, and this is still true, that gives you enough of a trail in your PayPal account that you can, in principle, follow it up with more money if you needed to. So if you wanted to, say, communicate with them and say, like, please pack it better, I will send you $10 more. It's the connection is already made, but it's right on the edge of what eBay would like you to do.
Right. Yeah, because they'll say, we wanted a percentage. If you're giving more money, we're supposed to get a percentage of all the money in this transaction. So another thing about shipping is, if you live outside of America, then, well, first, congratulations, but also second, you should know that, like, most of the things on eBay, it seems, are sold inside America. At least as a Canadian, I look at it, it's like, oh my goodness. And a lot of people don't want to deal with international shipping. And I don't think that's wrong of them. It can be a hassle. They say, like, it seems like maybe it's harder. Like, it really isn't. You just address it and you put more postage on or use UPS or whatever. But I get how a seller might say, I just want to sell locally. And also, countries outside of your own can seem really scammy or scary. I'm going to send it off to your weird Canada country, and who knows what's going to happen. But I have had some success in contacting sellers to say, hey, would you be willing to ship to me anyway, even though it's listed as only, say, shipping in America? And because sometimes people just list it as domestic only shipping because it was a default or something. They didn't really think about it. But if they're only shipped within, like, domestically for them, then you can use what's called a trans shipper. So a trans shipper is a company that basically has post boxes and you can use their address. So I, for instance, use a trans shipper that's located in the States. So I can buy something and it ships to the trans shipper's address. So for me, that's in Washington State or whatever. And when they receive a package addressed to me at that address, they rebox it up and they send it to me in Canada. So you end up paying more shipping because you're basically shipping things twice, but it will make something accessible to you outside of a country if the person in that other country is not willing to ship internationally. So some people might not be aware that exists. So that kind of service is called a trans shipper. If you just search for that, you can find lots of options that are available.
Yeah. So eBay has I forget now what they call it, but there's a worldwide shipping option that they partner with, which.
Oh, like a global thing. I see that every once in a while. So what is that?
Well, it's similar, except that you don't have to get your own, you know, you don't have to have your own trans shipper account. So what that means essentially is that the, you know, US seller would ship it to Kentucky somewhere, and then the person in Kentucky would ship it on. And so essentially what happens is the buyer winds up paying what I think turns out to be an incredible amount. I mean, like they are gouged for this shipping. but essentially, as far as you as a seller are concerned, you're only shipping it to Kentucky.
Okay. And is that set up by the seller or the buyer?
The seller says, I want to opt into the global shipping program.
Okay, so, got it. Probably because it's easier for them. It just prints out a label and they slap it on and they say, okay, now I'm shipping
it. Right. So if the buyers don't mind paying this exorbitant shipping cost, then that's a possibility. You can do international shipping yourself. You can just say you can either list the countries you're willing to ship to, or just, I think you can say everywhere. And then you have to, the reason I actually tend not to be keen to do that when I do list things is just because you'll get someone from Israel or something who says, how much is this going to cost? And then you'll get someone from Britain who says, how much is this going to cost? And you have to compute it every time.
Oh, you have to go and quote it around. That's a hassle.
So,
tell them it's $1 million.
Right.
I'm rounding up.
So this is,
I round up to the nearest million.
That's one reason too why free shipping. If you're relatively confident that you're not going to wind up paying to send somebody something, then free shipping does keep you from having to answer those questions.
Although then now you're eating the cost of that shipping. If now you thought you were going to sell it locally and suddenly it is somebody on the other side of the globe, you're like, oh my goodness, it just added $15 shipping and I'm selling a teeny tiny thing.
You mentioned, by the way, buying things from Venezuela. I mean, you mentioned South America, but...
Oh, yes, I think it was Venezuela is when I got those boxes.
A couple big warehouses there, clearly. But so I recently got something... I've gotten a couple from sellers in that area. I think there are a few, two different sellers, but I recently got something that got cut, I'm pretty sure essentially...
What do you mean cut?
Like, and sliced. And it was a padded folder, and it was cut open, and it could have been an accident. It could have been specifically to make sure there was nothing being smuggled inside the folder. But I think that is a risk, in some cases when you're ordering internationally, is that customs is going to want to make sure that you're not, that no one is smuggling drugs inside your 1984
sure.
thing. So it was kind of frustrating because the things I got were wrapped.
And then they could get cut open.
Yes, the things I actually received were no longer wrapped. So that was actually a case. I don't know if I did the right thing, but that was actually a case where I just didn't leave feedback, because I didn't want to say, well, it didn't show up right, but it didn't show up right, so I didn't want to say it showed up right, and so I
punted. So I punted. What else should we say to wrap up? One thing we should mention, I guess we haven't, is safety things. Like, one of the options instead of shipping sometimes is local pickup. So if you do that, just like if you're buying something on Craigslist, be sensible, be smart, either meet in a public place or bring a friend, or at the very least tell somebody you're doing that. Like, you're still dealing with, weirdo computer people. So if it is a local pickup thing, be aware. Don't necessarily, if you're selling, don't necessarily just bring everybody into your house. So that's a thing. Although when you do buy something, I guess you are giving that person your address. So if you're super famous, like you, Paul, then when you buy something, you have to hand out the where the Paul cave is, and then people will know.
Right. That is true. It has occurred to me occasionally, actually, not the famous bit, but just the fact that, people do know where they're shipping things to. So,
yeah.
I feel like there's a couple more things. Oh, on shipping, sometimes, I haven't noticed this as much recently, but sometimes people will offer several different options. So they'll ship it by U.S. Postal Service or UPS or FedEx or something. And usually when you are looking at the listing, it will just say, it costs this much and the shipping is this much. And if somehow the defaults are messed up, you might wind up seeing that the shipping is claiming to be, $48 or something like that, where if you picked something else, it would be $12. And so there's a way that you can kind of sneak an advantage out of that if everyone else stops looking at it because they think the shipping is too high, but you noticed that actually you could just pick a more sensible shipping.
Ah, right. Oh, I see, because if they defaulted to a more expensive one. Oh, that's a good tip. Another tip, if you're in Canada, is to know that different, or I guess maybe other countries, but definitely it happens here in Canada, different courier services handle their customs differently. And so if there are two different options, for instance, and it's $40 shipping from UPS and $50 shipping from FedEx, I will take the FedEx one because UPS will nail you so hard in there. They'll say, well, it's $35 for us to assess it for duty. Oh, there was no duty, so you only notice the $35. Like, well, what the heck, man? Whereas FedEx is also very expensive in their brokerage charges, but it's less in assessment and things. So you got to get to know, like, sometimes less isn't cheaper. Like, so UPS as a rule of thumb will cost you more on the receiving end. And a lot of people, I think, in the States, so I'm, oh, it's nice, I'm going to offer you a UPS, it's so much cheaper. I'm like, no, dear Lord, no. Or like a company like DHL, which is cheaper to ship, but is as down and dirty a shipper as you can get. Like, it will show up physically dirty, but also they will never ever deliver it. Like, the reality is, if it comes DHL, you're driving to a depot, because that's just, I don't think they actually have delivery trucks. It's just like, hey, why don't you come out here to Mississauga? Why don't I, DHL? Awesome. So you eventually get to know, like, which couriers in for your area are better. So that's a thing to at least be aware of, and that's something you eventually know by just, I guess, buying stuff. Another tip is don't buy right. stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if it, I'm not sure if it's a, I don't know which shippers do this. DHL might, but there are a number of shippers who still hand off to, at least here, the U.S. Postal Service for the last mile delivery or whatever you call it, that you know, DHL will ship it to your local post office and then it'll wind up getting it delivered with your mail. It might not be DHL, though. It might be
like Purelator or whatever. In Canada, Purelator would do that a lot because they used to be really tied to Canada Post, but I think so. Anyway, whatever. Don't buy stuff is my tip.
Yeah, right. One more thing I was going to mention, and it kind of goes in the other direction, is, you know, so we mentioned the global shipping program that eBay has and the existence of transshippers. And one point that is maybe worth making is that if you know you're going to buy a bunch of stuff, having your own transshipper account is pretty useful, because usually what they will do is allow you to send a bunch of things and then consolidate it into a single package and then send that, which is usually going to be, usually will be cheaper than a bunch of individual postages.
Good point. And also, individual sellers will do that too. Sometimes somebody's listing a bunch of things and you can buy five things from them and they will bundle them in and you'll save on the shipping. They will ship just one item from that one seller. That's another thing I forgot to mention.
Yeah. Okay, so now I've got bifurcated things I was going to say. But the first thing is, I have actually done a fair amount of shipping from Japan to here with a couple of different consolidation companies. And That has worked out pretty well. It's so expensive, but I mean, it would be so much more expensive to individually ship all these things. Mm. But the other thing too about, I don't know why I didn't think I'd mention this, but if you're actually just in the mechanics of eBay, if there are two things from a single seller, well, okay, so if you win a bid, if you win an auction, what can happen at that point is that a seller can give you an invoice. And so sometimes sellers will just like send you an invoice automatically. Like as soon as you won the auction, they send you an invoice saying, please pay. If you've won several things from a single seller, then if you go into the shopping cart, there's usually, I forget what it's called, but like request invoice, I think it is, a button that you can hit, which basically is saying, you know, could you please figure out what the shipping is for all these things together that I won? So that's the standard way to do it. And that's, you know, so that sort of encourages this bundling, and it sort of saves some hassle because then you don't have someone refunding you for shipping, which sometimes people will do. There's a couple of wrinkles with this. So first of all, it used to be much easier to do this request invoice thing, but for some reason the seller default has changed. So new sellers or sellers who haven't noticed that the default has changed often will have their account set such that they don't offer consolidated shipping, which is stupid, because usually they are perfectly happy to do that. It's just that they didn't know that the button doesn't work on eBay. So then I usually just send them an email saying, or like, you know, an eBay message saying, could you send me an invoice?
Yeah, and that's the thing to remember, is it's just individual people. So like the seller isn't some big conglomerate someplace. It's just a dude sitting in Sweden.
Right.
And it's like, you just contact him and say, hey, would you do this? And it's like, hey, sure, I'm a Swedish dude. I'll do that. There you go. And Jack Nutting says, absolutely, because Jack Nutting is all Swedish dudes. So they're all called Jack Nutting. It's just a very common name.
So, how long has it been?
I think that's good.
It's possible that we spent a long time on that. But
there was a wealth of knowledge there for you to impart upon others. All I keep thinking about is how when we talked about giving out addresses, I was like, I was so incredibly dismissive, the way only Only a male can be. Right. Like, I was like, boy, I bet you there's a lot of other people like, wow, it's your position just be so dismissive about handing out your address. Isn't it nice to be you? And it is pretty nice to be me, but I'm trying to be more aware of this stuff. Yeah. So
I often wind up having things sent to my work address anyway. You know, so
it's more convenient. I do the same thing just because it's easier if I'm not there. And also the post office often, I live in a condo, so I have a little teeny tiny box for mail. Anything bigger than that, they say, no, go pick it up at the post office. Whereas if it delivers to work, then it'll just be there. Even if I'm not there, somebody's there and they'll just sign for it.
Yeah, so if that's an option, it does. I mean, you know, then people have your work address, but at least that was probably somewhat more public anyway.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and safer and whatever. So yeah, see the wealth of tips. We could next episode, we could revisit this topic and do another 45 minutes on it. It's that good. This sweet, sweet topic.
All right. But let us move on. I'll mention a couple of listener feedback notes here. So Andrew on Facebook mentioned that we talked, I think, at the last episode on about the Amstrad PCW 8256, and Andrew mentioned that the floppy drive in that is a 3-inch drive rather than a 3.5-inch drive. And
well, that's weird.
Well, it's weird except for Amstrad, but yeah, it's sort of unique to that. So it's the same drive as the CPC 128, the ZX Spectrum Plus 3, he said. And the one issue with these is that if you have an existing drive, it has a rubber belt that has.
Oh, those things always stretch.
Has not aged well. Stretched and cracked and, so it is possible to replace the drive with a 3.5-inch drive or a GoTek, flash memory solution. So he gave...
Yeah, flash memory is the future.
Yeah. I mean, you can keep getting new rubber belts, but then, you know, the disk's media is going to fail, so... Anyway, there's a link.
But maybe that's the hill you want to die on. Maybe you're like, no, I'm going to keep getting rubber belts.
That's right.
In which case, I applaud you.
It doesn't seem like there are people who are making new floppy media anymore. So eventually all this stuff's going to flake off. But I vaguely remember, I don't know if this is a product that actually exists or if it was something that I thought something was and it turned out not to be, but it would be cool if you could get something that would be like a fake disk that isn't actually spinning media. It is actually some sort of flash thing that is like, you know, sending magnetic pulses to the head.
It would be doable because there were fake cassettes, and that's the same sort of thing, magnetic media. There were fake cassettes that you could put in a cassette player on a car.
You're right.
And so you could make the same thing. Oh, I think you should do it, Paul. I think you should do it and sell it on eBay. Now I know all these tips on how to get it cheaper from you. It's like, that would be the sweetest, most amazing thing ever if it was. Although if it's a 5.25-inch disc, it would have to be so thin. Yeah. Oh my goodness. It would have to probably be something that sticks out of the drive and just had a slot that goes in, but that'd be pretty cool. Yeah. It'd be difficult. I like it. I like the future you imagine.
I think I had one of those like fake cassette things that was actually also capable of like controlling an iPod. So like it would sense when you hit rewind and stuff.
Oh,
pretty wild.
That is lovely. Yeah.
But anyway, so there is a GoTek solution or a 3.5-inch actual drive solution on the CPC wiki. And
it was a long time before the Bluetooth in my car became more reliable than just a cassette adapter. And by a long time, I mean it's not quite as reliable yet as a cassette adapter. But one day, I hope, fingers crossed, Bluetooth gets it right.
Just about the time that the next technology emerges.
Nobody designs an interface as poorly as people who make cars. I hate all you car makers. You hear me? I hate you all.
I had I tweeted about this fairly recently, but I had this weird experience a few days ago where I was listening to a podcast and I was getting ready to go and I headed out the building and I got actually like almost to the sidewalk outside the building before like the podcast I was listening to started to crackle and fade out.
Oh, right. I remember you saying because it was over Bluetooth and you left your phone behind.
Like, and I can't.
So it's pretty remarkable.
It's amazing that it had that range.
Although I wonder how much of it was because it was streaming though. Maybe it's buffered. Maybe you had like 5 minutes of buffer.
It's conceivable, but that means
Bluetooth is awful. When in doubt, Bluetooth is taking me off. Like, it's, I wish it was better. It would be great if it was better, but, and it is kind of magical and good, but also, boy, howdy, after 15 connection attempts, and then it worked great. But yeah. The repairing. Oh, Bluetooth needs some repairing. All right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh yeah, that was my pun. There you go.
Very nice. Yes. I should find a bell to ding. But anyway, yeah.
And Quinn Dunkey will strap it to my forehead. Just ding.
Where was I? Oh, yes. Also, there's a link for replacement belts and a site for PCW disk images, if you want.
Cool.
Blake on Twitter recommended the Nerdly Pleasures blog, which I have not actually looked at myself, so I intend to. I verified that it was a link, but that was about as far as I got. But he said that it was the best deep dive retro computing blog he's ever come across. So that seems like...
Oh my goodness, and that's high praise from, yeah, from Blake especially. So
he runs his own deep dive retro computing blog.
I was going to say, like, if he's saying that, then that is something I am going to check out then. I will take that argument from authority, and I'm going to say it's valid. Yeah. So I have added that link to my personal readings now.
And this one wasn't directed specifically at us, but I will just mention that Josh on Twitter has a PSA, which is essentially get your batteries out. This is, you know, 2019, make that your goal, you know, to go through your collection, find your batteries and take them out. It's not that hard. Just get some clippers. It's better than destroying the thing it's in.
Yeah, and that's the thing that stops some people from doing that, I think. They think, well, I can't solder. I'm going to have to put something. No, you don't. If it has a battery, it'll run without it. So just like literally snip out the battery, and you can always deal with in the future putting a battery, say, back in that computer. And the worst thing is every time you boot it, it'll have the wrong date and stuff. That's fine. Set it up anyway, but that battery's probably dead regardless, so you won't notice a difference. But you will certainly notice it when it starts leaking acid all over it. So yeah. Good PSA is just like, doesn't matter, you can't solder. Just snip out the battery. It'll be fine. It'll be probably the same as it is now, and your future you or the future owner will be very happy about it.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't been responsible enough with my batteries, but I haven't seen too much damage, but I really need to... I did. There was a Macintosh 2 motherboard that was completely destroyed by a battery. Sometimes batteries are required for functioning. The Macintosh Portable, for example, is sort of famous for running off the battery.
Okay, good tip.
So, I mean, essentially what that means is you just can't use a Macintosh Portable because unless you do some sort of thing, because the batteries are all dead, and the way the portable works is running off the battery, and then the plug charges the battery so it can run off it. So if you just plugging in a Macintosh Portable does not suffice to start it.
But the vast, vast majority of things out there, you can just take out their battery. The batteries are all dead anyway, so right now it's running without a battery. Whatever it is, if it has a battery, it's running without it because they're all dead.
It's very sad.
Well, after you get done inventing your new floppy that's not a floppy, you can invent your battery. It's not a battery.
Batteries are tricky. It does seem like there should be some general solution to this, but...
Yeah, potatoes.
Wait, yeah, yeah. I think that's perfect, like a little lemon or whatever.
Exactly, just little tiny lemons in little cylinders and just solve all the problems.
I saw some photo of something. I think it was actually Michael who had posted something on our Facebook page, but and it was basically, it was a kind of like very basic Z80 computer of some sort, and it was running by being plugged into what I think was just like a battery pack of the sort that you recharge your USB devices with, but at first glance it looks to me like it was plugged into a lemon. and now I totally want to do this.
Absolutely. And just do the calculation, like how many lemons do I need to create the right voltage? That would be an excellent Hackfest thing at Kansas Fest.
Yes.
Have a 2C running from lemons. Just so many lemons.
Perfect. Okay. I think I'll stop there with the listener feedback.
Sure.
We can move on to items of interest and news.
Why not? Why don't we have some of that in the show now that we're an hour in? Why not? Let's do it.
Right.
Okay. I got the first one, which is pretty cool. So, on Granite Geek, site I didn't know very well, somebody's been pushing to get the Granite State, which I guess is New Hampshire. I did not know this. You know, along highways, they have those historical signs that say, you know, something cool happened here in the past and we're proud of it. Well, the New Hampshire Division of Historical resource has acknowledged that the state is now going to erect a new roadside official historical marker in Hanover. And unlike the, and I can't believe they don't comment on this number, 256, it's a number worth commenting on. Oh my goodness. Anyway, unlike the 256 others that already exist, this one won't worry about dead politicians or covered bridges, but will let the world know that BASIC, the first user-friendly computer language and one of the tools that launched the PC revolution, was developed at Dartmouth in 1964. I have some issues about, is the first user-friendly computer language? I don't know about that, but whatever. It's cool. BASIC is a cool thing and an important thing, and I think it's lovely that along the highway it's going to be acknowledged. And it says the sign will also acknowledge the development of the Dartmouth Time Sharing System, the DTSS, which allowed the creation of a sort of pre-internet internet that was the first connection to the online world for many New Englanders in the 1970s. So this is neat. This is a neat thing that the person who runs this blog or this site has been pushing for, and it looks like they've finally got approval. I say well done, New Hampshire.
Cool. We look forward to seeing photos when it eventually goes up.
I have driven through New Hampshire before.
Yep, as have I.
I'm sure I will do so again.
It is between here and Montreal.
Exactly. See, exactly. And so soon you will see that sign.
Yeah. That's true. I wonder if it'll be on a highway I travel. That would be pretty cool.
It'll be on the highway you now travel on. How could you travel on any other highway but that one?
Yeah, let me think. I don't know where Dartmouth is.
Show your support.
Do it. Exactly. I will now instruct Greyhound to go past the sign.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
So far, instructing them to be on time and stuff like that hasn't worked so well, but who knows? Okay. So the next thing is actually relatively short, but Barbara Karamejiev, whose husband, George Karamejiev, was the person who ran the Bozeman, Montana Computer Museum, the America Computer and Robotics Museum, has decided that she is going to stay and keep it open. She reopened the museum on January 2nd and plans to continue running it. So I think that's nice. I mean, like,
that's awesome.
I'm glad that it's going to still be around. I'm glad that she feels that it is important enough to continue having. I'm sure this is a rough thing to do. But,
yep. But also it's probably a way for her to stay, like, it's the thing that he loved. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way for her to keep alive something that was really important to him, even if it wasn't her bag, but maybe they shared this interest. And so this is fab. Yeah. Also just, that's a great thing. Hopefully though, I don't know what it says her age is, 63, and we don't all live forever. Right. So hopefully she'll live for many, many decades to come. But at this point, make plans for the next time it's in this situation.
Right. Yeah, and as I recall, it was George Karamejiev died sort of unexpectedly. This was not, which happens, you know. But you're right, that it does probably seem like that makes more obvious the need for some kind of plan.
For everything, for all the stuff. Yeah. Like, you eventually figure out, pre-make your eBay listings now, folks. Make it easier on your family. Isn't there a thing, if Jack was here, we'd talk about it, isn't there a thing called Swedish death cleaning? You heard about that? I'm pretty sure that's a thing. I'm pretty sure I'm not making this up. Next episode, Jack can talk a bit. That you get to a certain age and you're supposed to think, I'm not going to burden my descendants with all my stuff. And so you hit 60 or whatever and you start to, like, that's when you start to pare down and get rid of things and get it all in order. And I'm pretty sure it's called Swedish death cleaning. Or maybe that's a band name. I don't know.
I hope it's both.
It's one of the two. It's either a cool band name or it's a thing that actually happens. Might not actually be Swedish, but Jack will know. So tune into the next episode when we ask Jack about his plans for his Swedish death cleaning.
There's an umlaut on the W.
Of course. That makes it metal.
That's right. There was one time. First, I forget why I was doing this. I was actually seriously searching for a metal spatula. And I think I was looking.
Oh, dear Lord, did I have an umlaut on the U?
I think it was maybe a, I don't know, it was an Amazon search or maybe it was a Google image search. But so it showed me a bunch of metal spatulas, and then one of the images was a guitar. And I just found that very, very funny.
No, but if it was a spatula, and I'd sell two versions, one spelled spatula normal, that's say plastic, and one that's made out of metal, and you put an umlaut over the U in spatula because it's a metal spatula. You got to make it metal.
Awesome. Okay.
It totally is. I want to go into spatulas now just because of that.
Yeah. All right. GPU history.
Okay, so this is pretty cool. So Direct3D, you may be aware of Direct3D. As a mostly Macintosh guy in a lot of my formative years at Apple II, I think of Direct3D as that thing that everything wanted to have that my computers didn't have, or it was always ported. It was always the excuse for why we didn't have games, but whatever. So I have a bit of antipathy towards the Direct3D team, but that said, over at Microsoft, there's the Direct3D team. And as you can imagine, if they've been working on 3D stuff and developing 3D drivers or whatever they've been doing for so many years, they've had to test Direct3D against a ton, like just a boatload of graphics cards, of GPUs, over many, many, many years. And so you end up with, or they ended up with, like just boxes and boxes of them in this room, just like a sea of GPUs that they've tested with currently and in the past and over the years and what have you. I thought, well, what do we do with these? You got to keep them. So rather than just have them in a room, just piled in, they said, let's display them on a wall as a big timeline. So they set out a bunch of tape, they actually put it all. And so each GPU now, these graphics cards are mounted on the wall with basically a piece of paper behind them saying, here's what it is. And you can walk down this massive hallway and it's like the display of the timeline of GPUs from it says 402 different GPUs covering 35 years of hardware history. So you go down the hallway of GPUs beginning way in the past and up to the current date. And it's cool. Like, what a great way to make a display. And it's almost too bad this isn't like somewhere where the public can walk through instead of being the Direct3D offices. But it's a great start. And eventually maybe this thing can get migrated over to someplace that's going to preserve it more permanently. I think it's amazing. It's very cool to look at these photos. So well done them.
Yeah. Although these are photos for ants. I mean, they're very small. I like how at the far, far left, very beginning of this wall, they have an Etch-A-Sketch as the representation for the graphics card.
I hadn't noticed that. That's awesome. Oh my gosh, they do. So it's pretty fab. So each one, I mean, it's nicely done in that it like mounts on it, but it is really just they've put up a piece of paper, and on the right hand side of the paper, it's just typed some info about it. And so it's not maybe as polished as a museum display would be, but the having the items and having the information is more important than making it look pretty. So which is in a sense, I believe, Microsoft's slogan from years back. So it's really in keeping with that. But it's really cool. So you look at this down this hallway and it's just like, here you go. Here's the timeline of GPUs.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. What you had when you mentioned that, it reminded me somewhat of the thing that Backblaze does, which it's sort of a more modern thing. But they do offsite backups at huge capacities, and they release every quarter, I think, hard drive failure rates. So they essentially are doing like big scale testing on a bunch of different drives, and just essentially reporting on how often each one fails, so that you can kind of get a sense of how reliable the brands are, how reliable the models are, and that's it's sort of like this massive GPU testing that they were doing at Direct3D.
Mm-hmm. As you walk down this hallway, I wonder if, like, when you get to the end, it hands you a Bitcoin or something. Right. And it can be powered by your body or your static as you go through it. It's like as you walk down here, and it uses you to mine a Bitcoin.
All right, let's see. So the next thing I wanted to mention was, I haven't explored this in too great detail, but this is actual news.
As opposed to everything else we've said in the show so far.
Right. But so I think last time I talked about the Contralto emulator, which is a Xerox Alto emulator, but that had been released.
Or Xerox Star emulator.
Well, the Xerox Star emulator is the new thing. So the Xerox Alto emulator did exist before. And I only just discovered it and installed it and thought it was kind of cool, except that I didn't have a 3-button mouse. And in that time, since the last episode and this one, a Xerox Star emulator has been released by the Living Computer Museum and Labs. And there's on GitHub, you can get that. I haven't installed it and tried it, but this one is the kind of like more commercial attempt at that Xerox made at trying to get this out into the world. And there's an interesting article that sort of announces the emulator that kind of goes through the history and some detail and stuff. So I'm quite looking forward to looking at this. It's amazing that this is, you know, that someone made this. So
what's amazing is the incredible landscape of stuff I don't know or am wrong about. Like, it's just amazing. And in us talking about this, I've realized I have conflated the Xerox Alto and the Xerox Star in my mind for years. I think I used the terms interchangeably. I'm like, you know, they're that Xerox thing. That's kind of like a pre-Macintosh cool thing. I'm pretty sure I would mix the two up all the time. And I'm only just now realizing these are different computers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, like,
it's amazing what I don't know.
I was in that state, you know, a couple hours ago. So.
So looking at it then, the Xerox Alto is the first one. That's the earlier one from the early 70s, right? And it always had that tall monitor. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a big thing. I was surprised. It was, I think in the last year on this show as well, I realized that the Xerox Alto, you always see those pictures and you think of it as, look, it's a keyboard and this cool monitor. And mm-hmm. often the pictures aren't zoomed out enough to go. So see that
mini fridge.
Relatively big refrigerator underneath. Yeah. That's the actual computer. It's like, oh goodness. Oh, right. Okay. Much more in keeping with a 1973 kind of computer, but still to me, it looks so streamlined in the future. It's like, oh wait, it also takes this 200-pound thing underneath. So that's the earlier one, and then the Xerox Star is the later one then. So the Star would be the one from like 1980 or 81 or what have you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just so I have it clear in my mind.
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly when the Alto was from.
Wikipedia says March 1973.
Holy cow.
It's remarkable, right? That's the weird thing about it, is this is weird early magic thing.
Interesting. Okay.
It's like when people talk about the Dynabook, that amazing like mm-hmm. idea of a portable thing. It's, oh yeah, and it was from like, you know, 1800s, whatever, or 1960s, like so early. It's like, how are they doing, even imagining it so early? But yeah, so 1973 for the Xerox Alto, so early.
Interesting. Yeah, the Star, yep. It says, was 1981, and it costs $16,500 for a single workstation. So
why not just say it cost all the dollars?
It cost, you know, too much money for people to spend. I'm sure, you know, it's not, I have no reason to think that there wasn't that much value in it, but still, I mean,
because you look at it and you think, well, okay, so this looks like a really nice computer for 1993. Oh wait, it's 1981. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising, but just it's remarkable.
Yeah. So anyway, check it out. Read, you know, the blog post does sort of go over not only the history of the machine, but also kind of like what went into making the emulator, and links off to disk images and things that you can use. I mentioned with the Contralto, and I think this is true with this one too, that you need a 3-button mouse, and my laptop does not have anything that simulates that. So I'm not sure that I'll be able to get very far. But
you're going to have to buy a real one. Go on eBay. Use our tips.
Yes, exactly. Okay. I guess enough of that. You have another thing here.
Do I really? I do. Okay. So normally I would, there's a new magazine coming out, a new journal. Normally it's coming out in I think July, and it's the kind of thing I would wait till July to talk about. And look at this cool new journal about game histories. But there's a call out right now for submissions. So I thought, because of that, and because it looks so crazily amazing, we should just do a quick shout out to it now. So it's over at romchip.org, and the magazine will be called Romchip, and it's a journal of game histories. And the editorial team is super awesome and includes Rayford Greens and Henry Lowered, and I found it through mentions from Lane Nooney, who's somebody I follow on Twitter, and is super brilliant and does lots of cool gaming things. There's a whole really amazing editorial board on this, and it looks like it's going to be quite a very cool magazine. It's a journal, and I'm super looking forward to it, and it's because it's all going to be a scholarly journal about game histories, really, with, you know, computer game histories. And I think that's really exciting. And if you are the sort of person who is in a position to submit something, to write something for a scholarly journal about the, you know, a formal history of computer games, then hey, look, there's going to be a place you can submit to. How awesome. So you should head over to romchip.org. There is, as far as I know, no way to subscribe yet. I would happily subscribe now and say, okay, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to come out twice a year. I'm looking forward to the first one, and I would subscribe at the minute, but I think you can't. So, but hopefully soon we can subscribe, but right now you could submit. So if you know more about this stuff than me, then you should go submit things.
Yeah, interesting. I will be curious to see what's in here. It's interesting that there is an academic sort of area that includes this, but of course there would be. It just feels like my childhood, you know. It doesn't feel like a thing to study, but
well, exactly. But it is, and now's the time to do it. Well, people are still alive to interview, and anyway, it looks gonna be super awesome.
Excellent. Yeah, I had not heard of that until it showed up.
And all the stuff is going to be under the copyright will be Creative Commons. And so if you submit to this and they publish it, you still own the rights to the thing you did. Like, they seem like they're going to be doing it right. So I'm quite looking forward to it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I had one more thing I was going to mention, which is that, there was a tweet. I saw a tweet by Harry McCracken who says, I'm at a reunion of folks who worked on the Apple's Lisa, which was announced 36 years ago today. And that was yesterday as we record. So, you know, a week
That's
ago.
It's a pretty funny sentence. So it's remarkable that they could announce a reunion 36 years in advance.
It's conceivable. Well, it's not like he writes for a living, right?
He's at a reunion who was announced 36 years ago today.
Okay, so we're releasing the Lisa, and 36 years from now, I want you here.
We're going to have a reunion. So it's amazing. They were so forward-thinking, those Lisa people.
That's right. But it's pretty interesting, actually, just sort of like reading through the Twitter posts about this. And I don't know, you know, I hadn't heard about this event until I saw the tweet, but so I don't know anything further about it. Maybe next time we record, I will know more. Although David Grealish is doing, he's trying to put together a documentary on the Lisa, and I hope he's there.
They put a Lisa in a little basket, like a little baby basket, yeah, with a blanket on it.
Like a little birthday cake, I think it's just that it is.
Really ridiculous. Pretty cool. One of the things, there's some great photos, obviously, of a Lisa set up there, but looking at the back of the photo reminds me of an eBay tip we didn't talk about, which is something I mentioned, I think, on an eBay or an RCR episode years ago, because somebody at CancerFest once said, oh, when I buy things, I use that tip you said, which is you can't trust the color of photographs on eBay, because the white balance messes things up. Someone will take a photo of their incredibly yellowed Apple II, and it'll look totally fine, because your phone or camera will just automatically look at that and go, oh, that must be white, and it adjusts it. And so you can't tell. And things are often so much more yellowed than you think. So the key is to look at differences, to look at other parts. Like, here is a photograph of the back of the Lisa, and it shows how yellow this Lisa is, because there's also another panel that is still white. And so it gave it a white area for the white balance in the photo to lock onto. And so it shows accurately how incredibly yellow this thing is. Mm-hmm. So don't trust the yellowness. Everything on eBay is so much more yellow than you think.
Yeah, there's in iPhoto, there's a thing that there's sort of like a magic make the photo better thing. And one thing I found was sort of interesting about that is it's weirdly intelligent. Like, it will look and see, is there a face in this photo? And if there's a face in the photo, then they pick a profile, like a color profile, that kind of reddens things in a way. It does something to sort of bring out a skin tone. And I don't know how they define skin tone, but at any rate, it makes my photos like
probably offensively.
Yeah, if there's accidentally a face or something, and or like I'm taking a photo of the front of a CD or something like that, and I wanted the sort of relatively accurate representation of this thing, I'll often have to sort of undo that profile that it makes. So anyway, balancing things is tricky.
On the metal spatula tour, I think accidentally a face opened for Swedish Death Cleaning.
Right.
I would totally go see that line. And now, Chicago, welcome, accidentally a face.
Somewhere there's a Twitter account called, I think, like Faces and Things or something, which is super, super funny. I mean, it's just, you know, like, it's photos of objects, but your brain always, anything that can be a face can be sort of like...
Right.
Recognized as one, so it's like houses.
Well, probably because
have...
the people who weren't good at that all were eaten by things with faces.
Yeah. Anyway, yes.
So you were saying, sorry, at the very beginning of this, though, there, boy, I stepped all over the lead here. There was a reunion for the Lisa because it turned how old?
I think 36. is what.
36. Okay. Well, that's a weird number to have a reunion for then.
Yeah, I think it just happened to be, you know, everyone wanted a reunion.
Okay, sure.
There has been some movement on Lisa-related things. I mean, so one of the other links that I wanted to mention in this connection was Lisa2.com, which has existed for a while, but it is a, you know, very sort of pared down website. What is interesting about it is that it is in fact being served from a Lisa. So.
Oh, that's cool.
If you read through the text,
so we can bring it down. We can overwhelm that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was thinking actually in the show notes that I may well not have a link. It's Lisa.
RCR's first DDoS attack.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's a Lisa, you know. How much
we're can no it... slash dot, but I'm sure we can bring down a Lisa.
Anyway, so, and it's sort of interesting. This particular computer that is running it has a bunch of the kind of like modern update cards in it. So it has an X profile running the hard drive and cool. Some other emulators, a floppy emu running the disk drive. Okay. Is that it? I don't know. Probably.
Yeah, that's enough. Are we going to talk about upcoming shows?
Well, I guess we could. I sort of feel like so there's a couple of things. This can't be exhaustive because I only just like threw a couple things in here as they came across my radar. So CocoaFest is coming up. There was an ad, I think, posted to our Facebook group, which is how I know that. So if you want us to notice it, put it on our Facebook group. Mm-hmm. In Lombard, Illinois, as is often the case. And I think this is the 28th annual last.
Oh, this is the one Chicago that does that, Cocoa right? Fest. Okay. I want to go to this. Man, I like the Cocoa a lot. This is one that I'd like, and that's drivable for me. Problem is America is such a dumpster fire. Do I want to go to America right now? This is remarkably actually influencing my decisions lately, like, because what's happening on your country. I would like to go to this last, because it's the last one.
Right.
It's the last one. I got to get moving.
But anyway, beginning of May, May 4th to 5th, 2019. VCF East is happening. I believe the dates are known because there was some discussion on the mailing list about how on the Antic podcast they didn't mention when the dates were. They just said it was coming up, but I couldn't find the dates, and there's no official page yet on the VC Fed.
Yeah, it says the schedule's being determined. Oh, that's the 2018 one. So yeah, I don't see it either.
So we'll announce that later, but it's coming, unsurprisingly. And then, Carrington, you found one as well.
Well, because Kevin mentioned on Twitter, Kevin Savitz mentioned on Twitter that he's going to be going to Fujiyama, which turns out is a week-long festival for the Atari 8-bits that happens in Germany. I'm like, wait, what now?
When you wrote that, like, I thought it was going to be in Japan, but of course it does seem to be in Germany.
It's in Germany, and it's a thing that exists, and I don't know how long it's existed. This is flowing completely under my radar. We nicely let Atari people come to our Apple II week-long festival, and clearly all they were doing was scoping out info, and they've gone into competition with us now. I say us like I have anything to do with Kansas Fest. But yeah, so if you're looking for the Atari version of Kansas Fest, I guess it exists in Germany. I know very little about this, and a lot of the information that does exist on the net is in German, so I still know very little about it, but there is a thread about it on Atari Age, because Atari Age really is the keeper of all info. It's amazing how much stuff is on Atari Age. That is a remarkably good site. So we'll link to that, and Kevin is going to it, and so we talked about it a bit on Eaten by a Grew, the podcast that Kevin and I do together about Infocom games. And I was like, "What the heck do you mean? There's a week long thing in Germany that's for the Atari?" So if you're super keen on Ataris, then it's going to go weirdly. It starts, I would say, on Monday, the 26th of July, but it actually kicks off midnight on Sunday, the 25th. Seems strange. So midnight, the 25th. Of this is when it starts, and it goes through until the Sunday, the 1st of September. So it's a full week, Sunday to Sunday, which technically is longer than Kansas Fest. This is amazing to me that I didn't know this thing existed, because this is in its first year.
I wonder why they picked midnight. Maybe it's because it's 7 p.m. for us.
But you look at the photos, and there's photos like a bunch of people go to this. The photo looks very much like a Kansas Fest photo from a few years ago. They're catching up, man. This looks amazing. This is very cool. I'm not going, but I'm excited that it exists. And if you're keen on the Atari 8-bit, then get yourself to Germany.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. And I think now we have made it to the point where we break for a word from our sponsor.
That challenge demands a system that will automate the work experience in such a way that even on first contact, the machine will appear to be as familiar, friendly, and as simple to cope with as, well, as the top of a desk. And that's exactly what the Xerox Professional Workstation is. Familiar, friendly, and simple to use. On the screen, you'll find representations of familiar office objects which can perform the same functions as those elements they depict. By doing no more than operating this unique pointing device, which we call the mouse, and depressing the appropriate key, you can pull out a folder, open it, and select a document. Another click, and you can put it on the desktop. You might pull some information from your inbox and look at it. You might find that your report requires you to move a section of one document onto another, creating, in effect, a new page of information. It's at this point that the old way of working and the new Xerox system part company. Even before the paste dries on this, the professional at the workstation can send the finished document to the printer via Ethernet, or place it in the outbasket for millisecond distribution over the network. Done. The Xerox Professional Workstation. As familiar as a desktop, as flexible as the task and office environment demand it to be, and as simple to use as ordinary office tools. Automation for the professional. The next logical step in expanding the Xerox 8000 network systems.
Well, I suppose I could work in a shop of some kind or do freelance selling of some sort of product.
Bachelor City, we sell spatulas, and that's all.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retrocomputing gift idea this time is... I don't have any direct experience with this, but Benj Edwards, who we've mentioned in the past, is running the BX Foundry, which is the name under which he constructs really, really nice custom joysticks. So we're linking to the page for the BX110, which is a Super NES joystick. And I don't know too much about this, but they look very sturdy. They have like good arcade parts in them. You can order them in various color schemes.
They look amazing. Yeah. And on Twitter, people that buy them will then sometimes post, hey, thanks for my whatever, and I got it, and how amazing this is. And so, boy, the people who get these are very happy with them. So this looks awesome.
Yeah, they do. They do look very nice. I mean, I think if you're going to, you know, if you're gonna play games seriously, it's worth having a... It's like having a good chair to sit in. You know, if you're going to spend all your time in your chair... Get a good chair. If you're going to spend all your time playing games, get a good joystick.
Mm-hmm. But
anyway, yeah, they look really nice. This is the most recent model. He's made a few others. And this seems to be basically, he's gone all in the construction of handcrafted joysticks. So,
and I've seen online people, he's done custom things or people request a thing or whatever, so... He's a good guy making really good stuff. So I feel very good about recommending this. And so if you are in the market for a joystick for a vintage thing, particularly like these ones, then, click on over, purchase. Yep. This is good. I like it. Nice choice.
Yep. They're not cheap, but I'm sure that they're not more expensive than they need to be. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think it looks like a good value for what you're getting.
Yeah. There's no real store exactly. It's, either, sales over direct message on Twitter or through this web page that we'll link to. There's a PayPal thing, but it's all relatively personal, let's say. Okay, anyway, we can now move on to eBay, where Carrington has one and I have like eight or something.
Well, I wasn't going to have any, but then we had all these amazing tips at the beginning. So I found, no. So what I'm picking is, just like last time when I pitched you, Paul, uh-huh. on how you should buy a Quadro 630, because if you want to have just one computer that can do a bunch of things, it's an excellent choice. Quadro 630 lets you put in a DOS card or an Apple IIe card. You can have vintage Mac and like just a lot of stuff in a small footprint. And I like to not have a million things. So if you want to just make a little bit of space on one desk, but have it be a multifunction computer, it's a really good choice. Another good choice is this one I've picked today. Not cheap, $600, but it's a Macintosh Color Classic with the Mystic upgrade. So the Mystic upgrade is a Macintosh LC575 motherboard, which fits in a Color Classic. So it's basically been board swapped to a more advanced computer. And so the back panel often has to be off, although people do sell 3D printed back panels that will let you close it up. But it basically, it's a big old upgrade, and so it gives you an 040 computer, 040 processor instead of the 030 processor. So it's a big processor upgrade, really beefs it up. But one of the nice things about the Macintosh LC575 is it's one of the computers that can take an Apple IIe card. So when you, because it's got the PDS slot. So if you put an LC575 board into a Color Classic, it can still take an Macintosh LC2E card, which this listing comes with. So what you have here is a nice refurbished Macintosh Color Classic with the upgraded motherboard, with the Apple IIe card already installed. So you get it, and I see this as an excellent computer to bring to Kansas Fest. Mm-hmm. It's self-contained, it's luggable, it's got a much nicer monitor than those little tiny LCDs that people put on top of their 2Cs. It gives you an actual Apple IIe, well, in a card base that you can work on, but it also lets you have a very nice, decent, small footprint vintage Mac. So if you run and run Mac OS, you know, 6 through 8 stuff, and also play Apple IIe games in a nice toaster Mac configuration, this is an all-in-one, $600 US, which is a lot of money. And the seller actually made 4 of them and 3. And I was going to pick this last episode, but I wasn't on last episode, but this is going to be my choice. He's now sold 3, or she has now sold 3 of the 4. So there's one left available. They look really sweet. It's $600. That's a whole bunch of money. But the Color Classics with the Mystic card in them sell for quite a bit. They're often $500 on their own. Then you got the Apple IIe card. It's already installed. Everything's good to go. So it's not cheap, but it's not unreasonable for the cost if this is what you're looking for. And I think it's a pretty sweet computer. So that's my choice.
Nice. Yeah, I think...
Are you going to buy it, Paul? Are you going to buy it? Can I convince you to buy it?
I think not. yeah, I think of the seller as being one who prices things on the high end. I don't know if people... I'm fairly sure people do this somewhat intentionally, but... often you can sort of recognize the things that are from the same seller. So this, I recognize this because everything that the seller sells is on this weird little like blue green polka dotted backdrop.
Mm-hmm. So I have seen that as well.
But yeah, I don't have a Mystic upgrade for the Color Classic that I have, but I do have a Color Classic, and I'm pretty sure I do have a 2E card in it. That was my intention anyway. I don't know if I got around to putting it in, but
I think of this as the Ivan Drucker model of computer, because he's come to Kansas Fest with a Mystic updated Color Classic, I think with the 2E card in it. And I always thought that is a sweet rig he's got.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it's nice and small.
And it's got an updated hard drive. It's got 18 gig hard drive in it. That's been properly partitioned with like one partition with system 755 and one with 761 and one with 81. So, and it's got an Apple Ethernet card installed, because it's also Mystic also has the Ethernet slot in addition to the PDS slot. So that's an advantage of that over, say, a LC475, which you've got the one slot. And if you have the 2E card in, then you can't have Ethernet, although technically it's got a SCSI port, so you could use an Etherwave SCSI thing on it, but it's a little more complicated. So this one comes set up good to go. Ethernet's already in it, all the internet stuff installed. It's just like, get it, turn it on. You're going to pay for that convenience. But it's one of those things where, well, it's expensive, it's nice. It's like been completely refurbished. It's a good looking piece of kit. I like the Color Classic. I prefer the the industrial form factor of the older original Toaster Max, not the original. I actually like the SE and the SE30. That is my favorite look of those. And so to me, the Color Classic always looks a little newfangled. I don't like that quite as much, but that's just because I'm so incredibly old. But that said, like you get that nice screen that's in, you get a color screen. What I don't think has been done on this, but which can be done, is you snip something on the motherboard, you make a small change. Ivan Drucker would know. Get a hold of him. Call him at home. He's good. And you can make the display be 640 by 480 instead of 512 by 342 or whatever. So that would be another upgrade worth doing that you can't come back from, but is a nice upgrade. So because the 640 by 480 opens up more kind of software options. So, But it's a sweet computer in good condition with everything already installed.
Yeah, and I think you're right that you know, if you wanted to create one of these by buying all the pieces individually and putting it together, you wouldn't wind up that much better off.
Yeah, exactly. I think it seems to me like maybe you could save yourself $50 or $75 or whatever you did yourself, but that doesn't seem like an unreasonable fee to pay for somebody else to do all the work.
Right. Yeah, and as our lifetime grows shorter, just as soon not spend the time dinking around with this stuff.
Well, that's it. Exactly, right? So, and this isn't a computer for everybody, but I'm always on the lookout for those things where it's like if somebody says, look, I've only got so much. I'm not a Paul. I'm a Carrington. Like, a Paul has all the stuff. A Carrington says, I'm willing to make a 2x2 space on one desk for my vintage thing. So that's what you get. And that's all my space. So I'm often looking for those models that give you more than one computer in one. And this is one of those, and a pretty nice one.
Excellent.
That's what I picked with my eBay skills honed at the beginning of this episode. And what 50 things did you pick?
So I have various things of varying levels of interest. But the first one was something that showed up. I have a search for Popular Electronics 1975, and the reason I have that search is because there's one issue of 1975 Popular Electronics that is very sought after and desirable, which is the one that introduces the Altair 8800. And it's sort of famous for having, you know, on the cover, like a mock-up, because I think they lost the original one or something. it's the thing that's on the cover isn't actually it, but it's something that if you wanted to have a copy of it, you will spend hundreds of dollars probably, unless you happen to feel like find it in a friend's basement or something. And so I sort of picked this auction partly just because this is the full year, 1975. It does include the one that is valuable. And it's not, believe it or not, despite the fact that it is a buy it now of like 165, which is a lot for 12 magazines.
I could say that is a lot for 12 magazines.
It's not insanely expensive compared to what people have bought this for. This one is not in good shape. I probably would recommend not buying it because it's whatever. It's a magazine.
And I'm sure the magazines exist as scans.
Oh, yeah.
Like you can probably get this info. You just wouldn't have the actual item.
Yeah, this is a collector thing. I mean, so that's the weird thing about this. It's something that is for the collector market. You only care about this having the physical thing if you are in some sort of collector mindset, but yet it's not in great shape. So collectors are not going to want it. You can make an offer.
I like how in the show notes you said, I like how you pluralize it.
Popular Electronics.
Popular Electronics is excellent.
Anyway, so I thought I would point that out. If you happen to find in your basement, a Popular Electronics issue that has this Altair 8800 on it, that is, I think it's January 1975, someone's going to want that. Don't recycle it.
Send it to Paul.
Right. Or put it on eBay for something reasonable.
and hide it so that only Paul can find it with his eBay skills.
That was another thing I was going to say, actually, that is a little bit annoying. There exists a video game category that's separate from the computing category, and quite often things will get split across there. So if you're looking for rare software, you might want to search for like Apple II or Commodore or something within video games.
Oh, because I can see the general public saying, well, it's a video game. Yeah. Like, my mom wouldn't necessarily say, well, no, that's a computer software. It's one of those Vidya games.
Okay. You used to play VisiCalc back in the 80s, didn't you?
Big time. Got a huge score on VisiCalc. One thing is you could edit the score field yourself, so it was pretty easy to get a high score.
Okay, so the next thing I have is It is at Emma 2 Trainer, 6502 Trainer, which is sort of, it's sort of Kim 1-esque. It's not something that I'd heard about before, but it's it is from, I think the Emma 2 was from 1990, so it's not super, super old, but it's pretty old. That's kind of cool. It has a little keypad on it, and looks like it has most of the chips you would need. I'm not exactly sure. There, you can find scans of the manuals and things online, but I just kind of like these trainers.
So was this marketed as a follow-up to the Jane Austen novel, or was there a, an Emma EEPROM trainer at the beginning? Because it seems like an odd jump as a sequel, I got to say.
There was, in fact, a previous Emma.
When romance goes very bad, Emma will now marry an EEPROM trainer.
Cannot think of any Jane Austen jokes that involve 6502 mnemonics, but...
Just say things about social status and marriage, and it's almost certainly somewhere in an Austen novel.
I like the... well, whatever. Okay, never mind. I was going to mention the... I don't know when this came up. I feel like I just was talking about this with somebody. Perhaps it was on episode 185, but there's a... We hit a point where the... You know, like in 2019, a bunch more things became publicly available. You know, like the copyrights expired. And one of the things that the copyrights expired on in the past was Pride and Prejudice, was it? I don't know. There's one of these where like somebody took the fact that it was now in the public domain, and their value add was adding zombies.
Pride and Prejudice and zombies. Yeah. Yep, that is.
So it's all the original Jane Austen stuff with like extra bits inside added in about zombie interactions. But
and they got a movie series, I think, out of it, or a TV miniseries, or I don't know. There was also a film. Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah, it's sad, really.
I think it's one of those things where I'm not actually sure that I care to see the result, but I like the idea.
I like the idea of copyright expiring.
True.
I like that part of it. I like that part of it very much. I have strong opinions about copyright.
The Emma 2 thing, by the way, will almost certainly have expired by the time the thing comes out. But
you big tease.
But it's interesting now that you know it exists, you can look for it.
Exactly.
I like the fact that it's a 6502 also because I feel like I know how to talk to it.
Well, yeah, it's like the only chip I know how to talk to, and barely at that. Let's see what I do is finally dive into a different one. I'm like, my goodness, I never even got finished learning about the first one. Right.
I think people like the 6809 because it has many more registers that you can use and stuff. Anyway, okay, so I have also there's a CBM 4040 dual floppy disk drive. I don't know why did I pick this? I don't know. I mean, I think it kind of likes the fact
Commodore stuff from that. Like, I was never a Commodore 64 fan, but the CBM things, the industrial look of them, I love them.
Yeah,
I just love them. They look like good solid computers to me. You look at a like a PET or this thing, and they just look lovely and hefty and real.
This looks in fantastic shape. I hadn't actually looked at it so carefully, but it's $150 free shipping. So that's actually probably why I picked it, is because I realize that this thing weighs a ton, and the fact that it's free shipping makes that price not unreasonable.
What's fun about it is when you look at a Commodore PET from the era. Big solid metal thing, and it's so big and solid that it lifts up like a car hood, like you're going to lift up the chassis to get at it. And what I like is this is just the disk drive. It does the same thing. Like, it's so big and solid it lifts up to get, and that's just great. Like, I like these things where I can imagine it's like a car show where they've all got like the hoods up to display, but you do the same thing at a computer show where all the lifted up, and like that's just beautiful. That's just lovely design.
Yeah, I do. I do really like these. They take a lot of space, but I would like. I don't have one of these drives, and if there was one in a local basement, I would get it. I'm not sure that I would have it shipped to me, but anyway, yeah, this one is in great shape, and
looks brand new.
Thought was kind of funny was the seller says, you know, the drive did respond to certain commands, and you know, because this was being tested back when the seller had a PET, and I immediately thought perhaps the commands it responded to were stay. You know, that's about it. But it still, has the card in it, like the little cardboard thing that says, you know, remove before operation.
Yep. So like, how little is something used where that's retained?
Yeah.
Like, I can see somebody taking it out and using it, but the fact that they held onto those and stuck them back in makes it look like a drive that was never even used.
Yep.
Remarkable.
And it's super clean. I've seen a lot of really rusty, crappy ones. So,
hmm.
Okay, the next thing is actually a new thing, and it seems to be for a very small audience. But it is it's a USB keyboard adapter. So what it allows you to do is plug the keyboard from the original Macintosh into your USB.
Oh, the original one, the one that took like a phone cable, yes. Like an RJ22 jack or whatever.
Yeah. So it's not, it's...
That is a small market.
Yes. I mean, these are hard to get anyway, these keyboards. But
and then you're going to use that keyboard as your daily driver over USB.
I apparently, and there's some, I don't quite entirely understand how it works, but it says there are two programmable layers available so that you can map keys which aren't available on the old keyboards, like Alt and Function keys. So apparently there's some way that you can...
And it's a little teeny thing. Yeah.
It's cute.
This is remarkable.
It's it's $25. It's not a big investment. And if you had, for some reason, if you have, actually I do, maybe have a spare one of these keyboards, like more keyboards than Macs, then you could use this.
There you go. You are the target market. But, has anybody ever called you out, like in the title of an eBay listing? You just search for yourself and people are like, look, cool thing for Paul.
Interesting. It never has happened, but I wonder if it ever will.
I've never sold anything on eBay, but I now am pretty sure when I do start selling things on eBay, if I ever do, uh-huh. I'm going to totally call you out.
Here, Paul, look.
Paul, exactly, Paul Special.
I think I was just getting in kind of like a weird mood when I was looking through the eBay listings, because the next thing I had was just a book called Fix Your Own PC, which I imagined having a missing expletive there in the middle.
I'm going to say, yeah, fix your own darn PC. It does look like a book I would hand to other people.
Yeah, and I'm sure that wasn't exactly how it was intended, but it also made me think of... So this one I actually specifically searched for, the special edition using Microsoft Word 97. And I thought, because it kind of makes me think, what a sad thing. Like, nobody's ever going to want to read this. This is the time that this had for viability was very short, and it has very little historical significance. It's just how you use Microsoft Word, in some middle version.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to buy it, you can buy it for, the starting bid is $4, basically.
Weirdly, $4.10. $4 wouldn't be enough. I would make a, right. It says make offer. You can make an offer for $4.05 and see.
Right. That's one other thing that's kind of new, and it's a new thing on eBay, which is that I think maybe before there's a bid, you can also have a make offer option. So it's not only buy it nows that have this.
I used to only see it on buy it nows, and this one is not a buy it now, but it has a make offer.
So
it's $4. Like, how long are you going to negotiate? Like, no, can I give you three? What is it? A garage sale? I give you $3.25. Like, yeah. How much was your time worth to craft that letter?
Well, it's. I mean, I think this probably is for a situation where it's something valuable, but you. Yeah, like, so the bids will go high, but you want to just kind of cut it off.
Okay, then that makes sense. Here's the thing. Going back to your previous one, I'm still stuck on this fix your own bleeping PD. There's multiple editions of this. There are a lot of those on eBay for like $5.
Yeah.
$4.50. I can just see me having a stack of these in a drawer at work. People come up, you just like, they ask you, you don't even listen, you just reach down, not looking, you hold up, you just hand it to them. This is almost worth buying in bulk.
Right. Excellent.
Yep.
I feel like there was something else I was going to say about this.
About which, the Word 97?
Well, it was about the make offer thing that, because I did actually, this did actually just come up with something I bought. I forget now what it was. What did I just buy? But, it was an SSI game that I think was actually somewhat rare. Like it's not that SSI games tend to go for kind of a surprising amount, given that it's the same game, in 17 different varieties. But this particular one was, I think, 6-gun shootout or something like that, which I didn't have and don't often see. But so I...
No, are you sure, though? Because I find SSI games are like P.J. Woodhouse books. Uh-huh. It's really hard to know if you've actually encountered it before. Like, you can get pretty far into a Woodhouse where you go, hold on. Wait. Have I read this one? Stay with SSI. I swear there's only like 5 SSI games, but they came in 200 boxes.
Right. Yeah, and of course, since I'm kind of trying to like scan the manuals and stuff like that, it's I have been going after those boxes, but it's, anyway, this one, it did have a, you know, it had a bid thing and it had a make offer, and I made an offer, and then the, you know, the seller didn't respond, and then bids started coming in, and I won it for a dollar less than I offered, so fairly pleased how that
worked
out. Well
done, you.
But I was wondering if that was, you know, like, I always feel sort of bad when I make an offer and then it gets declined, and then the thing actually sells for like 9 times what I offered. But
well, why would you feel bad?
Well, just because I feel like
that's why they declined it.
Could be, yeah. I just I feel somehow this reflects poorly on my ethics of offers. But
oh.
Yeah, like if I knew it was going to be worth $900 or whatever, I should have offered something more. But
well, anyway. it's worth whatever you get for it. I don't think any of these things have intrinsic value.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's so irritating. Well, whatever. There's a cycle of things. There's a sort of commonly, I think I've commented on it before. Like if you go on Apple II Enthusiast Facebook group or whatever, there's a kind of a cycle where people will post an eBay link of something that is actually, you know, relatively rare that someone's asking a lot for. And people will say, oh, I have 9 of these, you know, I should sell these. And then someone says, I will offer $4 for this. And it's like, this thing is actually, it is actually rare. Like, I mean, you can mock it and say, I will offer $4 for it. But I mean, it is actually a $400 thing, and you can't find a $4 version of it anywhere. So what are you talking about? It, I don't know. I get sucked into that irritation pretty easily. Mm. I try to avoid commenting.
Facebook is pretty awful.
It is, as it turns out. I'm not sure that...
Another thing you could do is not go on Facebook.
People are trying to move to MeWe.
Yes, and I signed up for the MeWe thing. So I'm hoping something comes of that. Although after signing up, I haven't been back on MeWe.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of my experience too. I think that's been... Google Plus is shutting down kind of abruptly. And I think there was a fair number of communities on that that have... Many of them have tried to move to MeWe, and I don't know if it's gonna. I don't know if it's gonna go anywhere. It's a gravity thing, so we'll see. Oh, and so the next listing is just another sort of thing in that same vein. It was the Encyclopedia of Computer Science, a big hardcover book, which sounds kind of interesting. And it's from 1976, so another one of those things that you wonder if anyone is ever gonna read.
But that I think has probably more value, really. Well, I shouldn't say value, because like you might be interested in the versions of Microsoft Word, but to see like the state of an encyclopedia on a given date is itself very informative.
Yeah,
that's it's a big book that would take a lot of scanning.
Yeah, but you do wonder like what was the state of things at that point. But so it would be interesting for history. It would be probably a fairly poor way to start off learning computer science.
And the funny thing is, you can look forward and say, oh, we're making an encyclopedia. This is 1976. You fast forward 20 years, and this is now a CD-ROM set with embedded very tiny videos and things like that. Like, all encyclopedias went that way.
Okay, the very last thing I will mention is, and I think I've pointed to other auctions of this sort before, but this is a Xerox 822. 820-II, that is. And there's something that's just sort of interesting about this computer. I think maybe I just like what Xerox things look like. This maybe fits in a little bit with the star stuff we were talking about before. This is in super great shape, and it looks very complete. So, I don't know. I think it's cool. It's a $600 starting bid and $800 buy it now. It is in Johnson, Iowa. So it's expensive. But I have seen worse-looking 822s on eBay before. This thing, this is one of the best ones I have seen.
The funny thing about all Xerox stuff, I agree. I really like the industrial design of Xerox things. But part of them, this one, the Alto, the Star, they all kind of look like fake computers made to look like period things. Like somebody's going to make a movie.
Yeah.
We can't afford to put a real thing in there. So let's just get the prop department to make what would have been a computer. But they've made it too good, like it's too fancy. Oh, that's not a real computer from like 1982. You shouldn't have done that. You gave it too good a screen or too good. And it's like somebody overestimated early 80s computers, and it's a mock-up. It's like, which is in their favor. Like that's how good everything looks. But it's kind of weird because it's clearly of the period of computers I'm interested in, but it's so removed from the stuff I like of the circles I went in, because like, who the heck had a Xerox?
Yeah.
Like, nobody is their friend on the street. Oh, these are my Atari friends, my Commodore friends. This is the dude with a Xerox. It's like, who the heck are you?
Well, he probably also was driving a DeLorean and, you know, lived in a mansion.
Oh, I should have hung out with that guy.
I started watching The Goldbergs. It took me a long time to get to it. But
oh, any good? Do you recommend it?
It's basically about being a kid in the 80s, which I can kind of identify with. And it's possible that this also makes it hard to critically assess it. But I kind of like it. I think it's pretty funny. There are Apple IIe's and DeLoreans and things in it. So
I like Apple IIe's and DeLoreans.
Yeah, I'm not actually out of the first season yet. I'm way behind. So so I don't know if it gets worse. But it was pretty good at the beginning.
Cool.
Okay, I think that's it for the eBay things, and so we can move to closing discussions rather than rambling on.
I'd like to discuss how, since it's just the two of us, this should be a short show.
Yep, I think
we'll be able to knock this one out.
I don't know what happens.
Or we could spend an hour talking about eBay.
Yeah, I think it went all right. It's, you know, I had fun, even if it listeners
went great.
Didn't.
Exactly. No one's listening at this point anyway, so we can say what we want.
Anyway, anything interesting?
I have nothing. Other than yesterday, going to see my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Obligatory joke. She lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her. But mark that spot on your bingo cards, folks. It's got super snowy here yesterday, so I took my Jeep out of the underground parking. Thought, I'm gonna be a fancy man and put it in four wheel drive because I'm a fancy man with this fancy Jeep. Put it in four wheel drive. It didn't quite go into four-wheel drive. It kind of just stuck in neutral, tried to put it back in two-wheel drive, and it kind of locked in there, but the four-wheel stuff then lit up on the dash. And then it decided, you know, I don't think a transmission is necessary. And my Jeep's like, you know what? I like where I am. I'm like, oh, well, that's disappointing. So I'm currently trapped in my house because my Jeep is going to get people who know more about cars to do some car things on it. And we'll see what comes of that. But that's disappointing.
Sorry.
So I got that going on. So trapped here. So I was happy to spend a lot of time talking on the microphone because I got nothing else to do and nowhere I can go. This might explain the length of this episode.
Excellent. The snow just reached here. And of course, all the discussion in the news is very dramatic, but, you know, it's just not that much snow, really.
Nah, and it rarely is. It's just snow, whatever. And Toronto, we're pretty fortunate. There was one year, I remember, kind of famously, where we were unable to deal with the snow, and we had to call in, like, the army to come and truck things away and stuff. And it was a bit of an overreaction, probably. But for the most part, like, and I think same as you, I live in a city that gets a bunch of snow, but because of that, we have the infrastructure to deal with it. It's kind of a pain when a ton of snow lands, but then they bring out the trucks and they plow it and they salt it and everything's fine. It's cold and I don't like it, but it doesn't shut us down. Other cities, like if you get as much snow as we have at the moment, would basically, you know, shut them down because you don't have the infrastructure to deal with it. People don't have the tires for driving on it and that sort of thing. But we got a bunch of snow. It's not really, it looks pretty as long as I don't have to be outside in it. It's really not that big of a deal.
Yeah, Montreal's pretty good about dealing with snow.
Montreal's just pretty good, period. I like that city a lot.
Yeah. What have I been doing? I've been doing much less of preparing for the beginning of the classes that I'm supposed to be teaching than I should be. But I've been spending a bunch of time. When I'm not actually doing like my actual job or the retro computing stuff or whatever, I am also kind of like the web developer, volunteer web developer for the department I am in. And so I've been spending a bunch of this time working with the Linux pieces that go into that. So I've been setting up a email server and proxy web servers and trying to use Docker, and it's been a lot of fun, but it's I understand why people do this as a full-time job, I don't know that I have, you know, that many full-time jobs worth of time. But anyway, I'm almost done, so I can go to my classes when they start and show them the website at least.
Excellent. Well done, you.
Anyway, that's about it. At some point, I have started doing a little bit of disk imaging on the things in my office. So, because Jason Scott threatened to bring, you know, an army of people to image everything if I didn't get going.
Well, then it's good you have. I've been imaging more modern things, DVDs, stacks and stacks of so many DVDs, and so I'm slowly trying to build up the drives that will eventually become a Plex server or something like that. But kind of diving into what I'm intending to be the last time I rip these things.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, ignore how big it is. It doesn't matter. Space is infinite. Just rip the things. It's only DVDs. The quality is crappy anyway.
Like, yeah, I was just going to say. So DVDs have become super disappointing. Like, it's very sad that many of the things that I have are in their ultimate quality only, you know, whatever it is, 480 interlaced.
Yep.
Oh, it's like, but yeah, Plex is good. I have a fairly elaborate Plex server. I approve.
Okay, well, that is the plan. Whether it'll be on a NAS or I've got a spare mini or Mac mini, so maybe I'll run on that. I don't know, but I figure the first part is just get all the stuff ripped so I can finally get rid of these disks, boxes and boxes of disks. So
the Chromecast is actually pretty cool too. The iOS Plex app now can cast to the Chromecast, so I like that actually better than the thing you can do on a Raspberry Pi. So I would recommend that.
Okay, cool. Okay, good tip then. Thank you.
Okay, maybe we've really wandered far off from our stated topics here.
Yeah, I bought one on eBay with my vintage eBay skills. Right. There, brought us right back on track.
All right, I think we'll stop here. So,
do it.
That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php, and sometime I will actually go visit that. I haven't been there for years, but well. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast, and send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. You're a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbackreviews.com at a link in the show notes. And please write a review on iTunes that will help other people find the show. And so, until next time,
Retro Compute! Even with two of us, we couldn't time it right.
It always sounds kind of thin. Maybe I should bring in other recordings of people saying Retro Compute, like, so that there's 100 people.
I'll just say it a bunch of times. Retro Compute! Retro Compute! Retro Compute!
And plus, there can be I can add effects, so chorusing. And
exactly. You know, you should spend a whole bunch of time on
that. I think
that's
a
good
idea,
yeah. Paul.
I'm sure that the students in the upcoming classes will appreciate that a lot.
So you can just, for this episode, I'm going to play you the many versions of Retro Compute I've been working on.
That's right.
Retro Compute!